Good evening and welcome to Atlantic Tales on Clare FM. On today's show, we visit Doolin Cave in North Clare to see the largest stalactite in the Northern Hemisphere and hear about the business that has been built up around it. Single droplets of water dripping over hundreds of thousands of years have formed one mighty stalactite, which is not only the largest in Europe and only one of its kind in Ireland, it's the biggest in the Northern Hemisphere. The great 7.3 metre long stalactite weighs around 10 tonnes and reaches down from the roof of Doolin Cave on the edge of the Burren in North Clare. Formed beneath tropical seas, the Burren comprises tiers of limestone made up of the skeletal remains of marine organisms that populated those warm, shallow waters. The result is the strange but beautiful landscape we see today. Visible above the ground are the famous limestone pavements, and beneath the surface it's equally as spectacular. There are 200 known caves in the Burren, including the longest cave in Ireland at Pownal Golum, and cavers have been travelling to North Clare for decades to explore the Burren's mysterious underworld. One such cave was discovered by two young men in the early 1950s, and what was found inside left them speechless. That cave at Pownal Nunoin is now a successful show cave owned and operated by the Brown family. John Brown remembers when cavers began visiting North Clare to explore and sometimes discover.
All of this started just after the war, about 1947, 48 I'd say. Groups of cavers started to come to North Clare. There are a few had been coming before the war, but I'd say the war put an end to that then, and when things settled down again, people came back. And there were groups from Britain, from good lot of them from Yorkshire, where there was a lot of caves as well. Different parts of Britain, especially places that had caves, because they formed caving clubs there. And these guys were quite good at it, because they had been exploring caves maybe for maybe 70, 80, 100 years before that in Britain before. It wasn't done in Ireland, they just didn't do it. People, local people didn't really venture into caves very far. I think there was a lot of superstition about them too, that you'd never know what you'd meet down there, yeah. You know. Strange tales told about horses coming out of these caves in moonlit nights and galloping through the countryside and whatever, you know. So it had a kind of, there was a folklore about caves, and people didn't really go to them. But these boys weren't afraid of anything down there. And they started to arrive. I remember as a kid, back in the late 50s, we were going to school, and you'd see the all battered up jeeps, and these lads, and they having ropes and ladders and lights on their heads, and they heading out up into Kilmoon and up into the Burren looking for caves. And we were fascinated with this as kids. And I remember one of them, Trackman was his name, he was a famous caver and explorer. He used to stand outside the church in Listunverna on Sundays talking to the farmers after when they came out from Mass. And of course what he was after was, where are you from? Oh, I'm from up Balnalakin. Oh, is that right? Do you know, is there any holes in your land there? Oh, there is a hole. There's several places there. And he'd have a map with him. And, oh, that's interesting now. Oh, sure, come up and see it. Sure. You're very welcome. And he became very friendly with the local farmers. And he came back every summer, every spring, to Listunverna. And groups like that came. And loads of those people came back for years and got to know the local people. And, you know, there's a few of these guys from that time have actually retired to North Clare and are still caving. And they're in their 70s now, some of these lads, maybe even older. You know, so the link has still gone on. But these boys arrived anyway. They were the first cavers we saw, and probably the first tourists we saw in the summer, because tourism that time was pretty, yeah, it was okay, like, you know, but not like what you have nowadays.
In 1952, a group of explorers arrived in Listunverna from England, uncertain of what they might find, but certainly excited by the prospect of journeying into the undocumented underworld of the Burren. Two young men broke away from the group and went exploring an area a little more than 5 kilometres from Listunvarna.
A particular group came here and they were from Craven Potballing Club in Yorkshire. There were about 14 of them, I think, on the group. The oldest of them was in his 70s, and they reckon he was the toughest of them. Nothing would faze him. And the two young guys, they were in there about 18 years of age, Mike Dickinson and Brian Varley. The group came in here one day, and this was a meadow at the time, a green field, snow car park, and they were looking around, which they did, like, you know, they went from field to field and followed streams or whatever, any clue that might indicate that there's caves in the place. But they came in anyway and they had a look around and decided there wasn't really anything to report there. But the two boys, the two young lads, had a hunch that we'll go back there again. I don't feel that we have actually explored the place properly. So they came back about 3 days later, by themselves, told no one from the group where they were going, and they were carrying a length of rope, two lights and a small little fold-up shovel, which was the standard equipment if you went caving, looking for new caves. They came down here and they spotted the little stream coming off the hillside there. They followed it down into the valley here, and the stream went underground. So they pulled out a couple of rocks, enough to squeeze themselves in. Oh great, got inside, discovered there's a cave passage here. It's wide enough to crawl through. Come on, let's go. And they started crawling away through the passage. Now, they had no idea where they were going. They were doing a very dangerous thing because first time in a cave, there could be loose boulders. But that didn't faze them. Off they went, crawling through a narrow passage a lot of the way. Our lights weren't very good that day either. But they kept going, and they had just one thing in their favour. If their lights went out, it was a single passage. All they had to do was put their hand onto the floor and feel the water. And if the water was coming against your hand, you made your way back out. Yeah. So that was one thing that kept them going to explore it further.
But it was the water that piqued their interest in the first place. And just for context, the meadow was and the car park is now, the 50-60 foot cliff face?
50-60 foot cliff, covered in ivy, massive ash tree growing here just in the mouth of it. I don't know if the area was called Powlin Inn at the time or did they name it, because they named a lot of the places in the Irish names. But that means the ivy cliff or the ivy hole anyway. So it was the water brought them to it. Because if you see water disappearing around here, it's usually going into some sort of cave. And they knew well nobody had ever been in there before. It had that look about it.
So off they went anyway.
Off they went anyway, and they crawled away for, I don't know, was it three hours or something. And they began to notice that the cave was changing. The ceiling started to get bigger and they climbed up. And then suddenly they were in a big chamber and they turned round and they couldn't believe it. There was this enormous stalactite hanging down from the ceiling of the cave. Their description on the day was they whispered to each other because they were afraid their voices might actually knock it. And they tiptoed down, got closer to it because they had come in fairly high up in the cave chamber. They couldn't believe it. This was big stuff. They knew well this was very big stuff that they had found.
The young Varley and Dickinson couldn't believe that firstly they had found a previously unexplored cave and that they had also discovered a massive stalactite. But the teenage adventurers didn't stay around long to marvel at their discovery.
The boys didn't spend long there because their lights were beginning to fade. And they had only old carbide lights at the time. And they were tricky things anyway, they could go out at any time. So the boys anyway had to walk back to Listunvarna after their marvellous adventure. The two boys were staying in a tent across the road from the Irish Arms because they couldn't afford to stay in the hotel. They were too young at the time, like, you know.
Yeah.
So they were staying up there near Kathleen Givens' house on the hill there across the road from the Irish Arms. They all came down to dinner at night and they all sat down for dinner. And the two lads were there anyway, and they said they were going to bring the group back out in the morning and by the way go looking for this new cave. But they were so excited they just blurted out, "We found this incredible thing today. You'd never believe it." So they all wanted to leave dinner and come straight out and go down the cave. But the older man had said, "Now boys, sisters, take it easy. We'll go down in the morning. It's going to be there in the morning." So that was the first. They all came back in the morning. I think the first photograph was taken the next morning in the cave. And of course, the word went back to England and the news broke everywhere this had been found. And I remember hearing it when I was about, I'd say seven or eight, hearing about this marvellous cave that was up in Doolin, you know. I was always mad to go in to have a look at it. But I got my chance with these guys back in the, in the early 70s, I'd say. And I went down there to see it. Now, it was quite frightening getting down the first time you go down. You have to swing down on a rope and part of it that time, you know.
Okay.
But it always struck me after that. Jesus, people should see this. You know.
The discovery was seen by the cavers as significant by any standard, and word quickly spread around the caving community in England. It brought more cavers to see the great stalactite at Pawlin Nunoin and to explore other areas of the burren.
Well, the ones that had organised to come over, the news went round, because they're a tight group. It's not a major sport, like, you know. And they all know each other, and they spend weekends exploring caves in different parts of Britain, France, Ireland, wherever, you know. And the word got out. So, it probably spurred a few more cavers to come over. But while all that was going on, they were still finding new caves up in the burn. Big caves, long caves, big passages. So these cavers arrived, it was like discovering a new land, like, you know, because a lot of the caves of Britain had been mapped and explored by the 50s. Mind you, the nature of caving is that you can still find a new one. There might be something there on the back of the hill, and someday a place could fall in, water, a big flood might bring it, and expose another cave that goes around here for miles, you know. Most caves in the world are nearly in limestone. It's the limestone rock, and it's the way it's layered, and it's the nature of it. Because limestone rock started out in the oceans millions of years ago, 360 million years or something, they reckon, the limestone started to form. And of course, being in the seabed, all the animal remains of the marine life, when it died, it settled into the seabed. And slowly but surely, you got this, like in the bottom of a lake where you get sediments build up, this built up into rock. Now, it left little fractures in the rock, and the rain, water, lakes, rivers overhead it began to bore their way down through the limestone. Tiny little, no bigger than your finger, like, every cave started out to be that size. And just water and time create caves. That's how it happens. Now, you can see there, there's a massive cliff there. Across here, about a quarter of a mile, we'd say, there's another cliff. That space in between those two cliffs was once full of rock. And a river came down here through this, a massive river, millions of years ago, and cut away this valley. And this valley was a lot deeper, because when we went digging the shaft to put in the stairs into the cave, we found layer after layer of different materials. And most of it was the bottom of a lake or bottom of a big river. So, like, at one time, there was massive movements here of water, ice. Where we're standing had 300 or 400 feet of ice over at one time. No later than, 15,000 years ago, I suppose, there was still ice in this part of the world.
And the movement of those glaciers cut out the land
it
and shaped
out
the land
and it
that
brought,
we know today.
It brought loads of gravel, it brought loads of stuff with it. It also brought foreign bodies, rock, from other parts. And you'll still find bits of rock around here. You'll find them in the north of Scotland. Because this thing was on its way down from there, you know.
It was moving all the time.
It was pulling bringing the lot with it. It was like a massive big bulldozer, the ice, as it flowed along. And created what we see here today as the cliff face.
Coming up after the break, we'll meet John's wife, Helen Brown, and hear about how they progressed plans to open Doolin Cave as a tourist attraction.
Atlantic Tales on Clare FM, in association with Nolo Loughlin Insurance Services, for all your general insurance and life assurance needs. Call Noel 086 845 9912. Visit o'loughlinfinancial.ie.
Welcome back to Atlantic Tales. Doolin Cave in North Clare is home to the largest stalactite in the Northern Hemisphere. When John Brown first explored the cave himself in the early 70s and saw the stalactite with his own eyes, he thought, this is something people should see. It would be some time, however, before he and his wife Helen decided it was time to make the cave and stalactite accessible to the public. At the time, the Browns were already running a successful business in Doolin, as Helen told me.
We ran a restaurant in Doolin since the late 1970s. It was called Brook na Halia in Roadford beside McGann's McDermott's pub. It was the first restaurant actually in Doolin, at the time. And we kind of went along doing traditional Irish food. We used to serve fresh mackerel and Culkennan, beef stewed in Guinness, all that kind of thing. And then gradually, through the 70s, we started developing it a bit more. And it was a really popular restaurant for a long, long time. And then moving into the 1990s, we said, God, we can't stay at this all our lives, you know. We said, we better think of something else. Because it's so intense, you're as good as your last meal and you have to be really, you know, you have to give it your full energy all the time. So we said, we kind of looked around and we'd often thought about this, that this would be great to open it as a cave, because John had known it all his life and I got to know it really well. And we'd gone down a good few times. He had been down many times before I was. So we kind of started making inquiries and God, it was very, very complicated. We'd problems with the guy that owned the land. He didn't want to sell it, and then he eventually, we kind of talked him round. We applied for planning permission. First time took 3 years to get the planning, and that was in, we started in 1990 and we actually opened in 2006, and I'm going to write the book about what happened between 90 and 2006. I won't go into the details of it, but it was quite a struggle. And we eventually were able to open the cave to the public, but we weren't allowed any buildings on site. So we ran a park and ride from the restaurant at Doolin, which we at this stage our daughter was running it for a few years, and then we eventually leased it. It was successful enough, but we said, oh my God, this wouldn't work like commercially. It wouldn't be viable to keep doing it like this. So we applied for planning permission again and had to go through Bourg Pleinála and do the whole bit again. But this time round, the fact that we had opened the cave and that it was really successful and we hadn't done any damage to the stalactite, which was the biggie, and the county council gave us the planning permission, and then Bourg Pleinála gave us planning for the building. And we were very lucky. We met this South American architect that was working with a friend of ours in Limerick, working with Murray O'Leary, which was one of the big architectural firms. And she designed the building. The idea was that we'd kind of blend it into the landscape, that it would, nature would take it and would overtake the building, and that it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be an eyesore in the landscape. Because we're very much into the preservation of nature and the burn and all that kind of thing. And we eventually opened the cave. And we had really huge support through all that time with a really good friend of ours, Nuala O'Fuelan, who was a writer. But tragically, Nuala died in 2008, which was only 2 years after we opened the cave. We said we dedicate the building to her, and we have a plaque up there for her. Yes. And it was opened by Marion Finucane at the time, who we knew through Nuala. We knew her very well.
When John and Helen decided to pursue their plan to open the cave at Paul and Anoin to the public, they knew there would be challenges ahead. To ensure that it was possible to make the cave and stalactite safely accessible, John engaged geological experts and engineers, but first spoke with cavers he had come to know over the years.
From living in Doolin, I got to know some well-known cavers, British cavers, and one of them in particular, Tim Fogg, and his wife, Pam, used to come to Doolin playing music. He was quite a good flute player. We discussed it many a time, and he kind of put me on the road to other people. And it was amazing, like most unusual people kind of cropped up. Oh, I could give you a hand with that. You know, kind of once the word went out, and I got amazing help from people, and some of them you couldn't pay them. Okay, we're enjoying the crack, you know. When the planning was applied for, there were objections, and rightfully so, like, you know, there were questions to be answered about what way was it going to be done. Could it be done successfully without knocking down the stalactite? Was there going to be environmental changes in the cave? So all that had to be addressed. And one big thing, like, the planning people had, they wouldn't allow any talk of explosives. And that really changed the whole game, because we were in contact with people in Sweden who did microblasting. And what they did was, an area that had to be taken out, or the rock taken out of it, they put little tiny little charges into these little holes they cut in the, drilled in the rock, and then they just bang this. You could actually stand maybe 20, 30 feet away from this, what was going on, without getting damaged. And there was very little, no vibration. But at the end of the day, it was decided that the whole job would have to be done the old way, which was a big air-driven drill that drilled into the rock, and they used a buster which looked similar to the drill, same size bore on the drill, but the centre of the drill expanded in the hole and burst the rock. So it was done without no vibration. So that took a lot of time, that took a lot of money.
The vibrations, of course, would have been the concern. Was
there
always that concern?
There was.
You mentioned the lads whispering when they found the stalactite in case their voices would have knocked it.
Yeah.
This was obviously, John, the big concern.
It was, of course, yes. There were monitors ahead of that. They were wired up. That went to Dublin every week. Absolutely nothing happened. Then, before that, we got involved with Professor John Gunn from Huddersfield University, who had very well-known cave scientist and has worked all over the world and used to be the main advisor to the Chinese government. There's a lot of caves in China open to the public, and John was big part of that. So John brought his equipment over here 2 years before the planning was granted, and put the monitors in there, recorded the full 2 years. Those were the guidelines. So those guidelines would change once you start to bring people in. So we began to see that this cave was returning to its norm about 5 minutes after a tour left the cave. So we were having minimal impact on the cave. So that was a big part of it as well.
To gain access to the cave in 1952, young Varley and Dickinson had to dig out rocks and crawl through the narrow spaces before they found the great stalactite. The Browns decided, however, there might be a more practical way of gaining access to the chamber and began surveying the site. The option chosen was to drill down from above and install a shaft that would later house steps down to the cave.
The survey started here at the entrance, the original entrance, and there was a lot of things in the way there, unsteady roofs and broken slabs, and it was kind of decided, probably safer and maybe more practical to have a look and see could we, there was a place we knew was halfway house, or it was a place you could actually stand up, which was a fairly big chamber. We decided to do a survey there. So what we did was we got a drill, one they use like in a quarry. So we used that as an experiment and drilled down, and we found in this particular spot that we were hitting absolutely no rock. Everything that came up was shale, mud, clays, different stuff. And we did a survey there and decided this is the place to do it. The next phase then was, how are we going to put a shaft in here? You couldn't get the segments they didn't make them in the Republic, so every one of them had to come from Derry. And big lorries arrived here with these segments when we started to develop the cave. And these segments are bolted together, and the cave was dug downwards. The first line was put here in the ground, we'll say here in the flat. Then they went inside, they bolted this, it's about 18, 20 feet circumference. They dug down inside with a small little digger, just enough to put the next segment under the one they had laid and bolted together. Same thing again, and all the way down. But I would say that we had a great crew, because the guy, the O'Connells from Malahide in Dublin, were the company that did all the work. And they were excellent. And John O'Connell, he was as interested in doing it as we were, you know. Nothing would face him.
It wasn't just a job for him.
It wasn't a
he
job.
He was interested as
oh,
well.
Oh, it was, yeah. And he went back up to Malahide at the weekends, and all his mates in the rugby club there would say, how's it going down there? We'll be down soon. I met loads of people that had heard about it, the shaft being put in and the excavation of the rock from the passages. Word had gone out.
How do you go establishing then how old the stalactite is, how important, how significant it is? As I said earlier, the golden goose. And this is what sells the business.
It is, yeah. Now, I think John Gunn was probably the main person, because he had the data, he had the expertise on dating it and putting a program together of what would you do on a tour, because it was going to be a guided tour. So he wrote the tour for us. Our guides learned off the tour, and that's the way it works. We're still going on that same tour, as we've kind of taken bits out and put bits in since, like, you know, but it's the story of a chamber that's probably a couple of million years old. Stalactite, they're still kind of arguing over it, but they reckon it's pretty old. It could be up to 500,000 years old since it started to grow there first. So that's the way that was put together.
Okay, let's go see what all the fuss is all about.
Right.
Access to the cave is gained via a vertical shaft constructed by stacking circular segments, bolting them together, and then installing a staircase. At the bottom of the vertical access shaft is the horizontal passageway. In the early days, access could only be gained by crawling through the narrow passages. After years of hard work, a passageway in which you can stand up and walk was dug out, but is still wise to wear the hard hat provided.
So we decided, rather than go from the original entrance, to put an entrance here and intercept the cave passage at this point, because there was a lot of problems from this point back to the original entrance. So that's what we did, and we built this shaft and this this area here, and just start making our way down the...
How far down do we go?
We're going down 80 foot.
80 foot down, and then travel as far as...
Then we're travelling off along the passage.
And very importantly, everyone wear the helmet.
They pick up a helmet. So we got all our helmets and all our stuff here, and the tour starts at the front door here of the building. And you can see there's a tour just about starting there, and they're introduced to the place, and then they make their way in here, and off we go. You can see all the segments, and they're all bolted together. There's huge big bolts put through them, and as I was telling you there, it was dug downwards, and it was quite a tricky job, because it's okay here, you can see what's going on, but as you went deeper down, the guy on the crane lifting these segments down had to be really good. They brought this famous crane driver out of retirement to come to do the job, and he was brilliant. He was an amazing man. Paddy McGrath was his name. He was from Prosperous in County Kildare, and he was a famous man for skilled operator at this kind of work. Take your time.
It's not cold in here.
It's warmer in here than it is outside, I'd say, maybe at the moment. It's about, I think it's 11 degrees, winter and summer. So in summertime, it's nice and cool down here. Now there's massive amount of cement pumped into the back of these segments. So the whole thing, even in hundreds of years' time, if there's bolts rust away, it can't go anywhere. It's perfectly secure.
If anyone, I suppose, John, watched the program about the making of the London Underground or the Channel Tunnel, they're watching those segments going horizontally.
That's right. Yeah.
Here, they're vertical.
And the same guys that did a lot of the work here spent their lives in London, New York. They're specialists, and these guys had a lot of stories to tell. They were amazing.
Getting the right people obviously was essential.
By accident, I came across a guy from Tipperary, from Nina, called Leslie Dagg, who had worked in the mines, in silver mines, for many years. And Leslie called to me one day, and I think he had a great source of contacts, you know, because he put me in contact with a guy called Chris Price, who also had worked in the Nina mines, and he was a great help. He was an expert in mining. So, you know, it's amazing. Sometimes things just fall into place. You meet somebody, and they say, "Oh, I know somebody now that can help you with that."
So, John, a lot of hard work, but some luck as well.
A lot of luck. Oh, definitely, yeah, definitely.
Did you ever have a situation where someone said to you, "You're mad"?
Oh yeah, including my own family, a lot of them. Well, I suppose, you know, you get so far into something, and it's like the last race, horse race in the evening.
Yeah.
And you've got a fiver left, and you have to put it on and see what'll happen.
Take a chance.
Take a chance. Now you can see up the shaft there, right up to the top. That's quite a distance.
Now at the bottom, looking up, you realise how high it is.
Yes.
At the bottom then, we're going
horizontally.
We're going horizontally.
Definitely, yeah.
Coming up after the break, we make our way deeper into Doolin Cave to see the largest stalactite in the Northern Hemisphere.
Atlantic Tales on Clare FM, in association with Nolo Loughlin Insurance Services, for all your general insurance and life assurance needs. Call Noel 086 845 9912. Visit o'loughlinfinancial.ie.
Welcome back to Atlantic Tales. Doolin Cave in North Clare is home to the largest stalactite in the Northern Hemisphere. To gain access to the massive chamber and the awe-inspiring Great Stal, I'm making my way along with John Brown through a passageway where you can see lots of smaller stalactites, stalagmites and calcite columns. But that's not all that can be seen here.
I'll just make a stop here for a minute, Pat. I want to show you something. Where has he gone? There it is. That's a little animal that lived in the sea something like about 350 million years ago. And they're called crinoids. And they were like a little eel or something like that. And when that creature died, it settled into the mud and the sand that was that rock at the time. And over time, that rock got hardened to the strength it is today. And of course, the crinoid got trapped in there. And when the water wore away the limestone rock, it exposed the crinoid. And that's, you can see them that, but there's another one.
Another one, yes.
There's another one.
So are there many fossils like that?
You'll find them, yeah. Yeah, and I'll be showing you another one when we get in further into the cave. There's a lot of a lovely area here.
And it's getting noisier and noisier as well.
It is. You see this area here now? The water. You have a lot of calcite flow over the rocks here. And you see the really white parts there? That's the new flow of calcite. It changes over and back, the calcite does, different areas.
The cave is effectively growing.
Cave is growing, yeah. And even parts where we have exposed the limestone, you can see the calcite seeping out through it again.
Yes.
So over time, all that will form back into itself again.
As we get closer to the big chamber, we can feel a change in the air, and you know there's something special ahead somewhere in the darkness.
Now, you can feel big chamber, and hear the echo.
Yes.
Now, I'm going to turn off the light just for a second, and you can see that's the roof over there. So I'll turn out my light just to give you the idea of darkness, and then I'm going to turn on the light, the first light here in the chamber. Okay.
Oh, wow. The big unveiling.
Yes.
Oh, my good God.
Now, there she blows.
Because when you come up the final section of the access tunnel or cave, it's pitch black. You don't see
what's
standing there.
And that's part of our tour. We take you in here just with the torch on the floor, along the floor, and then we turn off the lights for a second and we have great fun with people, and people get a great blast from it.
It is. This is a... It's not often I'm stuck for words. It certainly is very, very impressive. It is huge. Much bigger than...
Its estimated weight is about 10 ton.
How does it stay up there?
They reckon that's the secret. That's what we call a little chimney. And there's another one there. It's actually growing. There is a chimney in the roof of the cave. And it's actually... has grown down from somewhere else overhead. So it's got a big root system, otherwise it would not have stayed there.
And how long is it?
It's about 23 feet long.
Do you remember, and I know it takes a long time to grow, do you remember it the first time you saw it?
Yes.
It probably hadn't changed much because...
Not at all.
Not at
no,
all.
No. It hadn't changed a lot since they were building the pyramids.
Of course, yeah. When you put it that way. This is, as we said earlier, this is the golden goose. This is the big attraction. There's all the excitement of coming down to the tunnels and all that, and waiting for the big unveil. It is very, very... And water dripping off it all the time. So it's growing all the time.
It's growing all the time, yeah. Anywhere you see the white calcite there, that's growth. Now, we'll turn... Our tour is coming, so we're going to get out of your way for a minute.
Just as I finished my personal tour of Doolin Cave, tour guide Richie Jones arrives with some more visitors.
Okay, well done, everybody. You can raise your heads now. You can relax a bit. You can hear the echo, so we know we're in a big cave. So for those two young English cavers, Mike and Brian, when they first came in here, they hadn't a clue what they were coming into. And they came in through the roof there, So it wasn't until they came to this corner here that they realised what was in the cave. And looking this way, they got a bit of a surprise. So this is the great stalactite of Paraninan. Just for the record, there's a bigger one in Brazil, in central Brazil, which is about three times the size. And there's also one in the Lebanon, not too far from the city of Beirut. The same kind of stalactite. This is called a free-hanging stalactite because it's coming out of the middle of a cave roof. So what we've got here is a very unusual cave. We've got a flat roof with a crack in it and a lot of water coming through it for a very, very long time. The result is this magnificent calcite formation. At the moment, it's 7.3 meters long and still growing very, very slowly, particularly at the tip, and it weighs several tons. Now, obviously, we can't take it down and weigh it, so we have to estimate. Yep. And we have some idea that calcite, when it's solid, weighs 2.6 tons per cubic meter. So there's a few cubic meters in this, so it is quite a lot of tons. Now, the first question is, how does it stay up there? Usually the children say, is it going to fall down? I can tell you it's not. It's pretty solid, and it's actually very well anchored. So if you think of a tree upside down, it's got roots going up through that crack in the limestone.
Richie went on to explain to his tour how the stalactite stays in place and is not at risk of falling. It's the big question the tour guides at Doolin Cave are nearly always asked.
Usually the children say, is it going to fall down? I can tell you it's not. It's pretty solid, and it's actually very well anchored. So if you think of a tree upside down, it's got roots going up through that crack in the limestone. There's actually a void up there which is also full of calcite. And no one's ever been up there, so what we did a long time ago was did radar, ground penetrating radar, and it shows up as a kind of a bowl formation, if you like, connecting up all the calcite. So even this stalactite in front here is connected above to the great stalactite. The difference is this one doesn't appear to be growing, so you can't actually see water running down this one or dripping off the end of it. It may be older, we can't actually prove that, but certainly at the moment it's not active. Whereas the great stalactite, you can very clearly see water running down all the way down it and particularly dripping off the end of it. So it's still growing very slowly. And we can get a rough estimate of its age from its speed of growth. It doesn't change very much between winter and summer, funnily enough. And I'm sure in this country, you know, we get pretty wild fluctuations in weather. Quite simply, it's the product of a drainage channel that's coming down through 70 metres of limestone. So it would take a severe drought to actually stop this growing, and we really don't get that in Ireland.
Can you estimate how much it grows between the time they discover and until now?
Yes, we get a very rough estimate of its age. They took the first photographs, by the way, in 1952, and it was maybe an inch shorter and a little bit slimmer on the way down. So it's mainly growing at the tip, and you could roughly say, at a very rough estimate, it's growing at about a centimetre every 25 years. So it's not in a hurry.
As Richie continued with his tour, John Brown told me how the great stalactite requires no maintenance because nature takes care of that.
Just leave it alone and say a little prayer every night before you go to sleep that it'll be there in the morning and everything will be quite right.
But that's not really a concern, though. You're happy enough.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you had a major earthquake in Ireland, it could go toorloo and that's the end of it, like, you know. But luckily we don't get, we've only get the odd little tremor. And I mean, the last serious earthquake we had in Ireland was in 1730 or something. And that was the time the city of Lisbon was wiped out by a massive earthquake. And it actually knocked some of the castles around here and caused landslides and all sorts of stuff. This stalactite didn't take any great notice of it. So it was just so far down, this wasn't so well anchored, the shockwaves didn't get to it. So hopefully it'll be here for a long, long time. We do a lot of monitoring. John, Professor Gunn is still involved here, so he writes his report every year. There's monitors, they're back in there at the back of that place, and there's a good lot in the main chamber, and they're recording the humidity, CO2 levels, temperature, all that sort of stuff. And the professor is delighted with himself. He says things are perfect, you know, really good. Because you do get show caves around the world where there's too much people going through. They're neglected. There's ferns and God knows what growing around the lights, and they're not well cared for. Our tours are small. Maximum tour is about 24 people. That's all changed since COVID, but it's a small show cave. It's family-run business. It's never going to be a major place. Like, it's going to be, I think, a good part of North Clare and doing its job as a tourist facility.
It's as you and Helen want it.
Yeah. indeed.
Boasting the largest stalactite in the Northern Hemisphere, it's no surprise that Doolin Cave is internationally known. Maura Higgins of Love Island fame visited Doolin Cave as part of her Love Ireland segment on one of the UK's most popular daytime TV shows, ITV's This Morning.
I honestly don't know how I'm feeling about being in the cave. It's quite spooky. I'm afraid in case there's bats. I mean, I'm wearing a hard hat. I've never worn a hard hat in my bloody life.
It's a good job I am, though.
Ow! I took a major thump to the head and nearly knocked myself out. What's wrong with me? I just keep knocking my head.
But tour guide Jim promises it's worth the trip to the centre of the cave, as I'm in for a big surprise.
Oh, wow. Jesus, it's massive.
It is incredible.
John and Helen's daughters were young when they began to pursue the idea of opening a show cave, but both are now very much part of the business. As Helen told me, one of the girls manages the business nowadays, while the other makes pottery from glacial cave clay, hand-dug 120 feet deep within the caverns of Doolin Cave.
Our family are involved now. Jenny is particularly, she's the manager. She runs the whole operation. And then Karen, our other daughter, she trained in art college. So she decided that she would set up a pottery business. There was a lot of clay deposits down in the cave, came, you know, from the ice ages. She researched it anyway and found it would make really nice terracotta pottery. So she's been doing that now for the last 5 or 6 years. And this is the only place that she sells it. She sells it online, but this is the only place that you can actually buy it. So it's a huge attraction. People love it.
So the natural clay from the cave is serving another purpose.
Absolutely, and it's processed. She self-processes it. It's a really complicated business. It takes about 3 or 4 months from between when it is dug up in the cave to when it's ready to be turned into pottery. So that's a really nice thing, and it's another lovely aside. People are very taken by the fact mm-hmm. that they actually can touch the clay or touch the clay banks down in the cave, and then they can see the pottery that's made from it. So that's something that's really exciting as well for us. So the two of them, both our daughters, have a livelihood
from the cave.
The cave.
While the big attraction is the great stalactite, there are still dozens of caves and passageways which form a substantial yet unexplored subterranean network.
Oh, there's a lot of potential here yet to explore more caves within the cave system. Now, that place there is called the 59 series, and it was found by Irish cavers in 1959, and they began to dig in there, and they made their way into quite another big area, two different chambers, two different heights in the cave system in there. Now it's a pretty lousy place to get into. There's a very narrow little place where you go through there, and the cavers used to call it the letterbox.
Right.
So you were being posted when you went in there. You had to go head first down, and then you had to turn your body sideways, and then you squeeze through. Unfortunately, the first time I tried to do it, I made a mistake, and I didn't turn my body at the right time, and I got stuck. And I got stuck. But luckily enough, Tim Fogg in front of me, his wife Pam was behind me. So they started pushing me over and back to see could they release me. And all Pam managed to do was pull off my Wellingtons. So that was no use. So Tim said, I'm afraid there's nothing for it, he says, but the old harsh treatment. So he was lying on his back, he put his big boot up to my shoulder, and he gave one bang, and I popped back out of the
wall. Wow.
So I didn't go in there for a long time after that.
Helen also remembers the first time she went exploring the cave.
I remember we went down and we bed, no more than the guys that found it in the beginning. We were not well equipped either. And I remember going down, there was a little drop at one part of it. Which was about a 12-foot drop that you had to go down on a rope. And I kept saying to myself, what are you doing, doing this? And then we had to crawl along on the stream. My knees didn't recover for weeks after. But I went in and I saw this thing and I said, what is that? You know, it's, you just don't believe that nature can create something as beautiful as that. I'll never forget seeing it for the first time. And it's amazing the amount of people that come up here after seeing this like that with tears in their eyes and say, you know, this is incredible, like, that nature can do something as beautiful.
Tourism stakeholders in the Burren, including Doolin Cave, work together as a network with the objective of establishing the Burren as a premier internationally recognised sustainable tourism destination. The Burren Ecotourism Network aims to be a collective of enterprises in the Burren, positively discriminating in each other's favour, and this, Helen believes, is working well.
That's hugely successful, and it's one of our, it's one of my, the, I have a lot of pride in the fact that we're part of that. And because the Burren is such a special place, it's great to see the people, and they're, as I say, they're mostly local family people that are involved in it. And that they're actually, you know, that it isn't the big, mad commercial way of looking at tourism, you know, which has ruined a lot of different parts of the world, you know. I mean, there's a big move now towards trying to bring back tourism product to the locality. Like, it's a huge business. I mean, it's been a huge business, not in the last 2 years,
but of course.
Do you know, so that's been difficult enough. But, like, we're lucky. I mean, I have to say thanks to the state for keeping the likes of us open, you know. I mean, we couldn't if we weren't getting some help for wages and that kind of stuff. But we're very hopeful that, like, I think basically the kernel of the business is successful. And there's a lot of talk about kind of lame duck places that they're given money to and that they might be better off to go. I find that hard enough to justify, because, like, anyone that opens a business is really doing their very best to make a go of it, you know. So, like, I mean, where it's been really unfortunate that it happened, in a way it makes you kind of sit back and think about your priorities too, you know.
Yeah.
It's empty in the valley of your heart. The sun, it rises slowly as you walk away from all the fears and all the faults you've left behind. The harvest left no food for you to eat. You cannibal, you meat eater, you see. But I have seen the same, I know the shame in your defeat. But I will hold on hope, and I won't let you choke on the noose around your neck. And I'll find strength in pain, and I will change my ways. I'll know my name as it's cold again. Fill my time. You take what is yours and I'll take mine. Now let me at the truth which will refresh my broken mind. So tie me to a post and block my ears. I can see where those orphans threw my tears. And know my cold despite my faults and despite my growing fears. But walking on your hands and see the world hanging upside down. You can understand dependence when you know the maker's land. So make your sirens call and sing all you want. I will not hear what you have to say, 'cause I